11. Jamie lay in a Stryker bed in Neuro, naked beneath a sheet, his face bandaged so completely that only one closed eye could be seen. A tube snaked into his nostril. A ventilator kept him breathing. Whoosh, thunk. Another machine monitored his heartbeat. Rob, the surgeon, had done what he could and then stepped back, shaking his head, saying, "I'm sorry, Frankie. I'll write to his wife tomorrow. You should say goodbye." Now Frankie sat by Jamie's bed, held his hand. The heat of his skin indicated that an infection was already taking hold.
"We'll get you to the third, Jamie. You hang on. You hear me?"
Frankie's mind played and replayed the last thing Jamie had said to her. "I love you, McGrath." And she'd said nothing. God, she wished she'd told him the truth, wished they'd kissed just once so she could have that memory.
"I should have."
What? What should she have done? What could she have done? Love mattered in this ruined world, but so did honor. What was one without the other? He was married, and Frankie knew he loved his wife.
"You're strong,"
she said, her voice strained. The nurse in her knew no one was strong enough for some injuries. The woman in her longed to believe in an impossible recovery. "Lieutenant? Lieutenant?" The voice seemed to come from far away, scratching, irritating, a thing to brush off. She realized a pair of medics were standing beside her. She noticed belatedly that one had laid his hand on her shoulder. She looked up at him. How long had she been here? Her back ached and a headache throbbed behind her eyes. It felt like hours, but it hadn't been long at all. "The bird's here. He's being medevaced to the third. A neuro team is standing by." Frankie nodded, pushed her chair back, and stood. For a second, she was shaky on her feet. The medic steadied her. She saw the duffel bag at his feet.
"Those are Captain Callahan's things?"
"Yes, ma'am." Frankie reached into her pocket and pulled out a felt-tipped marker and the small gray stone she'd been given by the young Vietnamese boy. It seemed like a lifetime ago that he'd pressed it into her palm. It had become a talisman for her. She wrote, "You fight," on one side of the stone and "McGrath" on the other. She slipped it into his duffel bag. She leaned over and kissed his bandaged cheek, felt the heat of his fever, and whispered,
"I love you, Jamie."
Slowly, she drew back, straightened. It took every scrap of strength she possessed to step back while they prepped him to leave and then rushed him out of the OR and toward the helipad. Halfway to the helipad, Frankie heard the medic yell, "Code!" and saw him begin chest compressions. Jamie's heart had stopped. Frankie screamed, "Save him!" They lifted Jamie onto the waiting helicopter. The medic jumped aboard, continued chest compressions as the helicopter lifted up slowly. Frankie stood there, staring up into the dust off. She saw the medic stop compressions, pull his hands back, shake his head.
"Don't stop! He has a strong heart!"
she screamed, but her voice was drowned out by the whir of the rotors.
"Don't stop!"
The helicopter flew up and away, merged into the darkness of the night, and became a distant whir of sound. And then even that was gone. Gone. How could his heart stop? His beautiful, beautiful heart. She closed her eyes, felt tears streak down her cheeks.
"Jamie,"
she said in a cracked voice. All she wanted was one more minute. Just a look, a second to tell him that he hadn't been alone in what he felt, that in a different world, a different time, they could have come together. The pounding thud of outgoing mortar shells and rockets was all that remained, steady as the beat of her heart. When she turned away, Barb was there waiting. She opened her arms wide. Frankie walked into her friend's embrace, let herself be held for as long as she dared. Arms around each other, they headed to the O Club. As always, the smell of smoke wafted outside. Inside, music. "We gotta get out of this place," their newest anthem. Barb pushed the beaded curtain aside. Inside, there were probably a dozen people gathered in small groups. No one was laughing or singing or dancing, not on this night, not in the wake of what had happened to Jamie. Some things could be partied away, pushed aside by booze and drugs and momentarily forgotten. Not this. Barb snagged a bottle of gin from the bar and then led the way to a ratty sofa and sat down.
"I imagine you're ready for a real drink now."
Frankie sat down next to her friend, leaned against her. Barb took a big chug of gin and handed Frankie the bottle. Frankie stared at it for a moment, almost said no thanks, and then thought, "What the hell?" She reached for the bottle, took a long, fiery swig, and almost gagged. It tasted like isopropyl alcohol. It was even worse than the whiskey she'd drunk with Jamie on her first night here. "You're safe, McGrath. I've got you." Barb took a drink. "To Jamie," she said quietly. "He's tough, Frankie. He could make it." "To Jamie," Frankie thought, forcing herself to take another drink. She needed something to dull this pain. She closed her eyes, but in the darkness of her mind, all she saw was the medic stopping compressions. Frankie wanted, just for a moment, not to be a nurse, not to be serving in a war, not to have worked in neuro, not to know what Jamie's injuries and stopped compressions meant.
"There's something else," Barb said. "I hate to bring it up now."
"What?"
Frankie said tiredly.
"My Deros came today. I'm out of here on December 26th.
Frankie had known this was coming, but still it hurt.
"Good for you."
"I can't do another tour."
"I know."
Finley, Ethel, Jamie, Barb.
"I'm so tired of goodbyes,"
Frankie said quietly, squeezing her eyes shut to keep from crying. What good were tears? Gone was gone. Crying didn't change it.
"To Jamie,"
she said again, more to herself than to Barb, reaching for the bottle of gin.
September 30th, 1967. Dear Ethel, I don't know how to write this letter, but if I don't say the words to someone, I'll keep lying to myself. Jamie is gone. I can't seem to breathe when I think about losing him. I want to believe he will survive, will make it home to his family, but how can I believe that with what we've seen? His wounds were, well, you know what it looks like. And I did my time in neuro. Anyway, I'm tired of losing people. It's been 3 days since he was hurt, and it's all I can do to get out of bed. I'm not crying, not sick to my stomach. I'm just numb, I guess. Grief tears me apart when I stand. They need me in the OR. I know that's what you'll say. It's what Barb says. I am trying like hell to care about that. But how can I walk into the OR and know he won't be there? I'll reach for him, call out to him, and someone else will answer. You'd think after losing my brother, I'd be a little more durable. He wasn't even mine. I keep thinking of his wife and his son. I want to reach out to them, ask if he made it, but it wouldn't be right. It's not my place. And he'll reach out to me if he can, won't he? Maybe not. Like I said, he was never mine. I miss you, girl. I could use your steadiness now, maybe one of your stories about galloping your horse through autumn leaves, or even one of your lectures on barbecue as a noun. Hope all is well back in the world. Love, F.
October 9th, 1967. Dear Frank, my heart breaks. For Jamie, for his son and his wife, and for you and all of the men he would have saved. Damn war. I remember how I felt when I lost Georgie. I don't think there's a word for that kind of grief. But you know what I'm going to say? It's numb. You meet people,
You form these bonds that tighten around you, and some of the people you love die. All of them go away one way or another. You don't carry them around with you over there. You can't. There isn't time, and the memories are too heavy. You'll always have the piece of him that was yours and your time together. And you can pray for him. One way or another, Frank, he's gone for you, and you know that. As you said, he was never your guy, no matter how much you loved him. For now, just keep on keeping on, Frank. Send in peace and love, girlfriend. E.
October 13th, 1967. Dear Ethel, today it's hot enough to roast meat on the hooch floor, I swear to God. I'm sweating so much I have to keep wiping my eyes. Thanks for your letter about Jamie. You're right. I know you're right. I can't keep thinking about him, wishing, remembering, replaying the choices we both made over and over. Fortunately for me, the 36th has been quiet for the past week, but maybe that's not good. Too much time to think. I guess I have to feel lucky to have known him and to have learned from him. Too damn many lessons to learn over here, but the one that's for sure is this. Life is short. I'm not sure I ever really believed that before. I do now. Thanks for being there for me, even from half a world away. I sure would love another picture from home. I miss you. Love you. F.
Frankie put down her pen, took a sip of warm tab, and folded up the piece of thin blue stationery. Leaning sideways, she put the letter on her bedside chest beside the stack of letters from home she'd been rereading. She should write to her parents, too. She hadn't written in days, unable to find the words to put a pretty spin on her life over here. She could write and say she was safe, she supposed. That was what they wanted to hear. Although in truth, that was what her mom wanted to hear. She had no idea what her dad wanted from her anymore. He hadn't written a single letter. According to her mother's frequent letters, everyone back in the world was talking about music and hippies and the so-called Summer of Love. The Summer of Love. There wasn't so much as a mention of it in the Stars and Stripes. It was vaguely obscene, as if boys weren't dying by the boatload over here. She leaned back against the wall and closed her eyes, hoping to fall asleep. She wanted to dream about Jamie. It had become comforting in a sick kind of way, obsessively remembering him. But now, instead, she thought about Barb's DeRose coming up in December. How could she survive over here without her best friend? A knock at the hooch door woke her up.
Come in.
The door opened. A young private stood there, looking nervous, his knobby Adam's apple bobbing up and down.
Lieutenant McGrath?
Yeah?
Major Goldstein would like to see you.
When?
Now.
Frankie nodded and got slowly to her feet. She reached down for her shoes and put them on. At the admin building, she knocked on the chief nurse's office door, heard a mumbled, "Come in," and opened the door. The major looked up. Frankie saw exhaustion in the slant of her shoulders and the lavender bags under her eyes.
"Are you okay, Major?" Frankie asked.
"Rough few days," the major said.
Frankie knew the major wouldn't elaborate. Major Goldstein was old school. There was a chain of command for a reason. Fraternization was out of the question. In a world where there were very few women to start with, and most were of lower rank and experience, it had to be lonely as hell. Certainly, the men who were of her rank considered themselves superior.
"You're being transferred to the 71st evac."
Frankie's stomach dropped.
"Pleiku?"
"Yep. It's near the Cambodian border, Central Highlands, deep jungle."
She paused.
"Heavy fighting."
"I know."
Major Goldstein sighed heavily.
"Losing you is pure shit from my end. I'll get some newbie nurse to replace you, no doubt, but orders are orders. You're a hell of a combat nurse."
She sighed again.
"So naturally, I lose you. It's the army way. Make sure your will is up to date, and write your parents a nice letter before you go." Frankie was too stunned, too scared to say anything except,
"Thank you, Major."
"Believe me, Lieutenant McGrath, you will not thank me for this."
Frankie left the admin building in a daze. Playku. Rocket City. She walked past a group of men playing football on the beach and a pair of uniformed Red Cross workers sitting in portable beach chairs watching the game. More shirtless men sat in chairs, getting some sun. Someone was setting up the screen and projector for tonight's movie. She found Barb in a beach chair, reading a letter from home. Frankie sat down beside her.
"I've been transferred to the 71st.
Barb took a long drink of her gin and tonic.
"Man, no one screws a woman like this man's army."
"Yep."
"So when do we go?"
Frankie must have misheard.
"We?"
"Honey, you know I love to travel. I can get transferred with you, no sweat. God knows they need us both up there."
"But Barb..."
"No talking, Frankie. For as long as I'm in this godforsaken place, I'm with you."
The hooch door banged open. No knocking. A swatch of hot yellow sunlight blasted into the dim interior. Barb stood there, still dressed in the khaki shorts and t-shirt and combat boots she'd worn to the ER this morning. Her afro was bigger now. In the past weeks, she'd let it go, called it her private rebellion. A young woman stood beside Barb, wearing her Class A uniform and carrying her Army-issue handbag and a soft-sided travel bag. Electric blue eyeshadow drew attention to her wide, frightened eyes. Frankie could see how the poor girl was shaking.
"I'm Wilma Coddington from Boise, Idaho," she said, trying to iron the stutter out of her voice.
Barb said,
"Land of potatoes."
"My husband is in Da Nang," Wilma said. "I followed him."
"A husband in country. How lucky."
Frankie made brief eye contact with Barb. They both knew a husband in country was potentially lucky, or extremely unlucky.
"I'm Frankie," she stood up. "Why don't you unpack? We'll show you around when you're done."
Wilma looked around the hooch. Frankie knew exactly what she was thinking and feeling. They'd all been turtles once, and the 36th was a carousel of people coming and going. Wilma would make it, become a more than competent nurse, or she wouldn't. Most likely she would, even without Frankie or Barb to train her. Major Goldstein would start her in neuro. The circle of life in the 36th. A rat scurried across the floor. Wilma screamed. Frankie barely noticed the rodent.
"That isn't the worst of what you'll see, kid."
Kid. They were probably the same age, but Frankie felt ancient by comparison.
"Don't drink water unless it comes from a Lister bag, Wilma," Frankie said. "That's as good a place to start as any."
October 20th, 1967. Dear Mom and Dad, hello from hot and humid Vietnam. I never told you about our beach party. I went water skiing for the first time. Then we had a mini American bandstand dance party on the beach. There are these naval helicopter pilots, the Sea Wolves, who really know how to have a good time. My friend Ethel went home, and Barb and I surely miss her. I never knew how intense wartime friendships could be. I've been at the 36th Evac Hospital for 6 months, and it seems that the brass wants me to move up north, into the Central Highlands, to the 71st. I'll send you my address when I know what it is. Barb is going too. Until then, could you please send some hand lotion, tampons? They sell out in the PX because the men out in the bush use them to clean their rifles. Shampoo, cream rinse, and I sure would love some more C's. And I'm almost out of perfume. The boys love it when I smell like the girls back in the world. I'll write again as soon as I'm settled. I'm nervous about the transfer, but excited too. This will really sharpen my nursing skills. I'm sorry I haven't written for a while. I lost a good friend recently, and I've been in a bit of a funk. But I'm getting better now. Not much time here for grief, even though there's plenty of cause. Life isn't always easy, as you can imagine. People come and go. But I love nursing. It's important you know that,
and that you know I'm happy I came here. Even on bad days, even on the worst days, I believe this is what I'm meant to do and where I'm meant to be. Finley told me once that he'd found himself over here, that his men were important to him, and I know how he felt. Love to you both. F. Frankie's first sight of Pleiku was from the air, in a supply helicopter, looking down at the dense green jungle below. Barb sat on the other side of the chopper, peering down too. A flat pad had been cut into the lush green mountainside. A huge square of red dirt held a ramshackle collection of tents and Quonset huts and temporary buildings. Looking at it, Frankie remembered, or finally understood, that the 71st was a mobile army surgical hospital. It struck her suddenly what that meant. Mobile. Temporary. In the jungle near the Cambodian border, where the Viet Cong knew every footpath and clearing, where they planted bombs to blow up their American enemies. Coils of concertina wire protected the compound from the jungle that encroached on all sides. The chopper dropped down to the helipad. Barb and Frankie jumped down as several soldiers moved in to unload supplies, including the nurses' footlockers and duffel bags. Everything in, around, or about helicopters had to be done quickly. Charlie had no greater target than a landed bird.
"Lieutenants McGrath and Johnson," said a short, bulkily built man in faded fatigues. "I'm Sergeant Alvarez. Follow me."
Frankie clamped her boonie hat onto her head and angled low beneath the whirring rotors. Red dust flew up, swirled, made its way into her eyes, her nose, her mouth. He pointed to the Quonset hut nearest the helipad, yelled,
"ER! That one's pre-op!"
He kept walking and talking and came to another Quonset hut, its entrance stacked in sandbags.
"OR! There's a large airbase nearby," he went on, "as well as the village of Pleiku. Don't go to either without an escort."
He led them deeper into the camp, where personnel moved in a rush. There wasn't much here, some Quonset huts, a row of dilapidated wooden huts, tents. Everything was stained red and surrounded by barbed wire and protected by armed soldiers in guard towers.
"The morgue," he said, pointing left.
Frankie saw a tired-looking medic pushing a wheeled litter with a body-bagged soldier through a pair of double doors. Inside, she saw body bags stacked on tables and cots, and a few even on the ground.
"I know it looks shitty compared to the 36th, Sarge said, not stopping. "And the rainy season lasts for 9 months up here, but we have our benefits."
He showed off an area he called the park, which was a stand of rotting brown banana trees, their giant fronds bent over and decayed, and an honest-to-God above-ground swimming pool full of brown water and leaves. Off to the side was a tiki-style bar, complete with torches and a sign that read, "Hula Spoken Here." Beside it, a sandbagged bunker and a dozen portable chairs waited forlornly for partiers.
"The officers have some kick-ass parties here at the park, ma'am. You can find someone here most times if you're feeling angry or blue. Ain't much space between those emotions here in Rocket City."
He pointed out the commanding officer's trailers and walked past a row of unimpressive wooden huts. Up ahead were the latrines and showers.
"By 1500 hours, the water feels almost warm," he said.
At the final wooden hut, built up on blocks and layered in sandbags, he stopped and turned to them.
"Home sweet home." "Get settled in, lieutenants," he said. "This quiet, it won't last. The fighting in Dak To has been brutal this week. Your duffels will be delivered ASAP. Shifts are 0700 to 1900 hours 6 days a week, but if we're short on staff, and hell, we are always short, we work till we're done."
He opened the door. The smell made Frankie almost gag. Mildew, mold. Insects and dust motes thickened the air. Inside the small, stinky space were two empty cots, upon each of which sat folded woolen blankets and a pillow that she already knew neither of them would use, and two rickety chests of drawers. Red dust coated everything, even the ceiling. For the first time, she thought kindly and nostalgically
about her hooch at the 36th. Frankie turned back to thank the sergeant, but he was already gone. She followed Barb into the hooch. They stood there, shoulder to shoulder.
"My mother would pass out," Frankie said at last.
"Spoiled white girl," Barb said. Frankie tossed her purse and travel bag on the empty cot nearest her. They landed with a squeak of metal that did not inspire her confidence for a good night's rest. She felt insects feasting on her bare arms and legs. Slapping her own thigh, she unpacked a few belongings and carefully arranged her family photographs on the rickety dresser. Then she tacked up a picture of Jamie. In it, he was leaning against a post, holding a beer, giving her the kind of smile that lifted everyone's mood. She stared at it longer than she should have, then felt the start of tears and turned away.
Barb unpacked her posters. Unfurling them, she tacked them up on the wall, a trio of her idols, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and Muhammad Ali refusing to be drafted, with the words, "I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong," stamped across his body.
Frankie opened the creaking makeshift dresser drawer, saw that it was full of rat droppings.
"Shit," she said. And I mean that literally, shit.
She started to laugh, and then heard an incoming chopper. Frankie slapped her thigh again. Her hand came back bloody.
"And here I was thinking we had time for a little gin rummy," Barb said.
"Or to do our nails," Frankie answered, stripping out of her shorts.
She put on her fatigues and gathered her supplies. A lighter, a roll of bandages, scissors, a flashlight, chewing gum, and a felt-tipped pen. She looped a length of Penrose tubing through her belt loop in case she needed to start an IV and snapped a Kelly clamp on her bagging waistband. You never knew when supplies would be lacking, and being prepared could save a life. Outside, the whomp-whomp of the helicopters was deafening. Frankie and Barb ran past the helipad, where wounded were being offloaded from a dust-off and coming in by ambulance. Men covered in mud and blood, working together, shouting at one another beneath the thwomping rotors. In the air, a row of helicopters hovered, waited their turn to touch down. A grizzled-looking black medic was running triage in the ER, determining who would be seen when. Sawhorses were being set up quickly to hold the men on litters. A screen in the back corner shielded the expectants.
"Lieutenants Johnson and McGrath," Barb said, "from the 36th, surgical nurses."
He looked at their bloody, stained fatigues. It meant they'd been in the shit.
"Thank Christ,"
he said, loudly enough to be heard over the din of yelling men and helicopters landing and taking off. He pointed to a Quonset hut.
OR-1, report to Hap. If he doesn't need you yet, try pre-op."
Frankie and Barb were halfway there when the red alert siren sounded. Seconds later, a shell exploded on the ground not far away from them. A sound like pelting gravel hit the Quonset hut. The air stank of smoke and something strangely acrid. Something whistled over Frankie's head and thudded behind her. At OR-1, Frankie wrenched the door open. Inside, bright lights, men waiting for surgery, lying on tables. She and Barb washed their hands, then grabbed scrubs and caps and masks and gloves and found Harry Hap Dickerson, a lieutenant colonel, operating without assistance on a deep belly wound.
"Lieutenants McGrath and Johnson, sir, reporting for duty."
"Thank God, cart's there," Hap said to Frankie.
"Johnson, that's Captain Winstead over there. He'll need you."
"Yes, sir."
Barb ran toward the other doctor. Another rocket blast, this one close enough to shake the Quonset hut. The lights dimmed and went out.
"Shit! Generators!" Hap yelled.
Frankie pulled out her flashlight and flicked it on, directing the narrow yellow beam on the wound. Seconds later, the lights came back on, accompanied by the hum of the emergency generators. The rounds kept falling, raining fire on the camp. Thud! Whoomp! The explosions were so close they rattled Frankie's teeth. The noise was excruciating and heightened Frankie's sense that hell had broken loose here. Helicopters coming and going, the mortar attack that went on and on and on,
the hum of suction machines, the drone of the generator, the snapping of lights on surging electricity, the hissing of respirators.
"Hap! It's Reddick! He's in trouble!"
someone shouted above the melee.
"Can you close?"
Hap said to Frankie, stepping back from the patient. "Yes," Frankie said, but her hands were shaking. Stitching up an incision was one thing. Doing it with too few doctors and nurses, unreliable electricity, and bombs landing nearby was a whole other world. She closed her eyes, brought Jamie to her mind, then Ethel. She felt them beside her. "No fear, McGrath." She heard Jamie's voice in her head.
"It's just like sewing, McGrath. Don't all you nice sorority girls know how to sew?"
Frankie closed out the chaos and the attack. When she felt calm, she closed the belly wound, then handed the patient off to a medic, washed her hands, put on new gloves, and followed Hap to another table.
"Hey, pretty,"
the patient said to her, his voice slurring, his eyes lowering heavily. He was a Marine undergoing anesthesia.
"Are you here to watch my game?"
She looked at his dog tag. "Hey, Private Wade." She kept her gaze on his face, careful not to glance down where both of his legs had been severed mid-thigh. Thick yellow tubes were draining the blood from his chest wound, pumping it into a suction machine at Hap's blood-splattered boots. Another rocket hit. Close.
"They're targeting us," someone yelled. "Mandatory blackout in 3, 2, 1.
The lights clicked off.
"Get down!"
"Lower the table," Hap said.
"Put me in, coach,"
Private Waite mumbled.
"I can score."
Frankie and Hap lowered the operating table as low as it would go. The nurse anesthetist lay on the floor, monitoring the gauges with a flashlight. Frankie knelt in the blood and turned on her flashlight, held it in her mouth. For the next 10 hours, she followed Hap from surgery to surgery in the blackout darkness. They peered at each other through flashlight beams. The wounded kept coming, wave after wave of men brought in broken and in pieces after the fighting at Dock Tho. There were South Vietnamese incoming too, soldiers and civilians, children, filling the wards, the hallways, the morgue, overflowing outside. Finally, Frankie noticed a lessening of the noise. No dust-offs landing or hovering, waiting to land. No bombing. No ambulances rumbling toward the OR. The lights in the OR snapped back on, jarringly bright. Hap pulled off his surgical cap and lowered his mask. He was older than she'd thought, fleshy, with large pored skin and a dark shadow beard that had probably sprouted during the push.
"Hey, McGrath, good job. First day at Pleiku and a mortar attack."
"Is this what it's always like here?"
Hap shrugged. It had been a stupid question. Frankie knew there was no always anything in Nam. Everything moved, changed, died. People and buildings came and went overnight. Roads were built and abandoned. Hap tossed his surgical garb into an overflowing waste bin and left the OR. Frankie stood there, unable for a moment to move. She felt people around her, nurses and medics cleaning up, moving things around, rolling out gurneys. "Move, Frankie." It took an act of will to simply lift her foot, to take a step. She felt dazed, overwhelmed. She walked out of the Quonset hut. The squishing of her socks told her that, impossibly, there was blood inside her sneakers. Her feet hurt from standing for so long, and her knees ached from kneeling. Outside of post-op, she saw dead men on litters, overflowing from the ER, out into the walkway. She'd never seen so many wounded in one mass cal. The morgue was worse, black body bags stacked up like cordwood. The darkness popped with noise and distant rocket fire. Here and there, beyond the glimmering silver of concertina wire, she saw blots of yellow light moving through the jungle. The enemy was just beyond the wire, barely out of machine gun range, watching them, planting bombs and trip wires. Rounding the corner of the Quonset hut, she saw Barb sitting in the dirt, knees drawn up,
back resting against the metal wall, her green canvas boonie hat drawn low on her forehead. Frankie slid down the hut's wall to sit in the dirt beside her. For a long moment, neither said anything. The distant pop thud of the war raging in the mountain underscored their breathing.
"This is not the vacation we signed up for," Frankie finally said in an uneven voice. "I want my money back."
Barb's hands shook as she took a joint out of her pocket and lit it up.
"We were promised champagne. Talk about out of the frying pan and into the fire. I feel like Frodo in Mordor," Frankie said.
"I have no idea what that means."
"It means give me that joint."
Barb looked at her.
"You sure, good girl?"
Frankie took the joint from her friend and drew in a big lungful of smoke and immediately started coughing. She laughed for a second, said,
"Look, Ma, I'm doing the drugs."
And then she was crying.
"Jesus, what a night,"
Barb said. Frankie could hear the trembling in Barb's voice and knew her friend needed her tonight, needed Frankie to be the strong one. She wiped the tears from her eyes and leaned sideways, put an arm around Barb.
"I've got you, girlfriend."
"Thank God,"
Barb said quietly. And then, even more softly, under her breath, she said,
"How will you do this alone?"
Frankie pretended not to hear. 12. There were more than 450,000 American men in Vietnam now, and God knew how many deaths and casualties. You certainly couldn't find that answer in the Stars and Stripes. Many of the new troops in country had barely 6 weeks of training. Unlike in World War II, when soldiers had trained together in platoons and went to war alongside men with whom they'd trained, these new recruits came alone and were dropped in wherever they were needed, without the support of a platoon, without men they knew they could depend on. Army basic training had been shortened to get the men in combat sooner. Frankie wondered who in the hell decided that less training for war was a good idea, but no one had asked her opinion. There were good days, though, when few wounded came in and the sound of helicopters was far away. Days when the nurses played games and read novels and wrote letters home and organized medcap trips to local villages to offer medical services. On bad days, Frankie heard the distinctive roar of the twin-engine Chinook helicopter, the workhorse behemoth that could hold more than 24 injured, and knew trouble was on its way. Sometimes the pushes were so intense, the numbers of incoming and their injuries so bad, that Frankie and Barb and Hap and the rest of the doctors and nurses worked for 18 hours straight on both soldiers and civilians, with barely a break for food or drink. Frankie had learned to think fast and move faster. She could do more than she'd ever imagined. She could initiate a surgery or close a wound or put in a chest tube. Hap trusted her with morphine administration and talked her through all of his surgeries, teaching her every step of the way. And some of this took place under direct rocket attack and mandatory blackout conditions in a pouring rain. Now, it was just past 0300 hours, and the last surgical patient had been wheeled to post-op. No sound of incoming choppers, no mortar attack, no red alert siren. Quiet. Not even a sprinkling rain. She reached for a mop, began to clean blood off the cement floor. It wasn't her job, but she did it anyway. She was both dead on her feet and full of buzzing adrenaline. She shoved the mop forward through the blood, pushing it away. It slimed right back where it had been. Hap entered the OR, nodded at the corpsman at the desk doing paperwork. He approached Frankie, slowly, touched her shoulder.
"You don't need to mop, McGrath."
He was giving her that look. She knew it now. Sadness wrapped in compassion, wrapped in understanding. It was how they all looked at each other after a mass cal, when all you could really count were the men you'd lost. In the past 10 days, most of them rainy, Frankie had spent well over 100 hours across an operating table from this man. She knew that he never sweated, no matter how hot it was or how tough the surgery was. She knew that in easy moments, he hummed "Ain't That a Shame" under his breath, and in harder times, he made a clacking, angry sound in his jaw. She knew he wore a wedding ring and that he loved his wife and worried about his oldest son. She also knew that he made the sign of the cross every time he finished a surgery and that, like her, he wore a St. Christopher medal next to his dog tags. He smiled tiredly.
"Get out of here, Frankie. I thought I heard dancing at the park. Let off a little steam or you're going to blow."
Frankie knew he was right. She peeled off her gown and left the OR. At her hooch, she picked up clean clothes and a towel. She took a shower in the dark, washed her hair, and dressed in a t-shirt and shorts. At her hooch, she traded her blood and mud-stained sneakers for huaraches and headed to the park, where the music of the Beatles greeted her. She saw a trio of men standing over by the makeshift tiki bar, drinking and smoking. The stand of frayed banana trees rustled beside them. Tiki torches glowed yellow and sent a thread of black smoke into the night sky. Barb sat in one of the beach chairs near the stereo setup, smoking a cigarette. Frankie pulled up a chair, sat down beside her. A cardboard box, overturned and stained, created a coffee table that held a half-empty bottle of gin and an overflowing ashtray.
"You took a shower," Barb said. "I hate that about you."
"There was blood in my armpits. How the hell does that happen? And the water was cold."
"They should put that in the So You Want to Go to Play Coup brochure." "Let's face it, you've got to be crazy to want to come here."
Frankie reached for the pack of cigarettes and lit one up.
"We got mail today. My brother Will sent this," Barb said, handing Frankie a Polaroid picture of thousands of people standing or seated on the ground with the White House in the background.
Someone held up an Impeach LBJ sign. Another sign read, "My son was killed in Vietnam. Why?"
"Why, indeed," Frankie said, leaning back, trying to work a kink out of her neck. "My mom sent me a newspaper article about a march in D.C. 100,000 protesters gathered at the Lincoln Memorial."
Frankie didn't know what to say about that, or really, what to think about it. The world of hippies and protesters felt far, far away. It had nothing to do with the guys dying over here, except that it did. The protests made them feel that their sacrifices meant nothing, or worse, that they were doing something wrong.
"The world is upside down."
"Yeah, no shit.
I heard that Canada is demanding the U.S. stop bombing North Vietnam. Canada! You know you're doing something wrong if you piss them off,"
Barb said, exhaling smoke.
"Yeah."
The headline of the latest Stars and Stripes was, "It's almost over, winning the war." But they'd been saying that since Finley had been killed. And look at all the deaths since then. There was no winning in war. Not this war, anyway. There was just pain and death and destruction. Good men coming home either broken beyond repair or in body bags, and bombs dropping on civilians, and a generation of children being orphaned. How could all this death and destruction be the way to stop communism? How could America be doing the right thing, dropping all these bombs, many on villages full of the old and the young, and using napalm to burn whatever was left?
November 7th, 1967. Dear Mom and Dad, this is a bad night for me. I'm not even exactly sure why. Today was just another day at the 71st. Nothing particularly horrible. God, I can't believe I even wrote those words. If I chose to describe a mass casualty, you'd be horrified. I'm horrified, and I'm even more horrified that normally I can get through it. Do I want to know how to see these things and still breathe and eat and drink and laugh and dance? It feels obscene to have a life, and yet, given what these soldiers give up for their country, for us, it feels obscene not to. The fighting near Dokto has been devastating.
And it is not just American soldiers who are being killed. The Vietnamese people are suffering and dying too. Men, women, children. Last week, an entire village was bombed and set on fire. Why? Because no one really knows who the enemy is over here, and our boys are being killed by jungle snipers, and they're jumpy as hell. It's dangerous to be scared all the time. What a waste of life and promise it all is. The only thing I know is that the soldiers, I used to think of them as my boys because they were so young, but they are men fighting for their country. I want to help them. I'm trying not to think of anything else. For a few, I'm the last American girl they will ever see, and that means something. You wouldn't believe how many want to take a picture with me before they leave. You keep writing about war protests and flag burnings. None of that is in the Stars and Stripes. And Barb's mom said Martin Luther King says this war is unjust. I'm starting to wonder about it myself. But can't they support the warriors and hate the war? Our men are dying every day in service of their country. Doesn't that matter anymore? Much love, F. P.S. Send hand lotion, perfume, cream rinse, Polaroid film, and candles. The damn electricity is constantly going out. A heat wave hit the Central Highlands in mid-November. The ever-present mud dried out, turned into a fine red dust that coated everything, filled every breath, turned their tears red. No matter how often Frankie placed a wet cloth across her brow, there was no getting rid of the dirt that stained the new creases in her forehead, settled in the lines that fanned out from her eyes, coated her teeth. Fat red drops of sweat slid down the sides of her face and along her spine. In its way, the heat was as demoralizing as the mud and the rain. There was no sleeping in this heat, and that meant the park was packed after work with people listening to American music, trying anything to ease the sharp edges of their war. "Go, Frankie," Hap said, taking her by the shoulders, turning her toward the doors of the OR. "Barb left an hour ago." Frankie nodded. Had she fallen asleep on her feet for a second? Too tired to argue, she pulled off her mask, scrubs, cap, and gloves and tossed them away. Outside? Daylight. She blinked, confused for a moment. What time was it? What day? Move, Frankie. She left the OR and stepped outside onto the walkway. There were pods of people about, looking tired, not much talking going on, drifting in and out of the mess hall. In front of the morgue, she saw a single litter, positioned between two sawhorses. Beside it was a stack of body bags. She headed slowly toward the litter, drawn to the loneliness of the man lying there, hoping he hadn't died alone out here. He was young, so young, and black. He had one limb left, his right arm, and it hung limply over the side, his fingertips just inches above the bloody ground. His youth upended her. She was 21 years old, and she felt ancient. All these young men who'd come here, most of them by choice, being shot at, ripped apart, broken into pieces. The majority were black or Hispanic or poor, straight out of high school. They didn't have parents who could pull strings to get them out of service or into the National Guard or college classes to keep them safe or girls who would marry them. Some volunteered just to choose the branch of service, rather than be shipped out in whatever service when their number came up. A generation gone. Her generation. Dirt and blood streaked his face. She could see clumps of sweaty skin where his helmet had been. She couldn't help wondering who he was, what he had believed in. They all had stories, these guys, stories that they'd thought would go on for years, through marriages and jobs and children and grandchildren. She saw a helmet nearby and bent over to pick it up. A Polaroid picture splattered with mud stuck up from it. This young man, in a white tuxedo coat and black pants, wearing horn-rimmed glasses, with his arm bent at a crisp 90 degrees. Beside him was a black girl in a long gown, wearing elbow-length white gloves, her hand tucked into the crook of his arm. Senior Prom 1966 was scrawled on the white border of the print. On the back, it read, "Come home, bees. We love you." Frankie gently wiped the Polaroid clean and put it in his pocket.
"At least you'll be going home," she said quietly, touching his cheek. "That will mean something to your family."
In the distance, she heard a mortar thud and explode, and then nothing.
She was so tired of watching young men die. Instead of turning toward her hooch, she went to the park, where people sat in chairs watching a movie.
The rat-a-tat-tat of the noisy projector garbled the dialogue. Frankie knew that no movie would ease her loneliness or dim this new and acute sense of impending doom that had attached to her. But it was worse to be alone than to be among people. She sat down in the chair beside Barb, who handed her a drink.
"What are we watching?"
"The Great Escape."
"Again?"
"One drink," Frankie thought. "Just one." On their first day off in 2 weeks, Frankie and Barb sat in chairs in the park, a cooler beside them, drinking lukewarm tabs. Barb was reading a letter from home aloud.
November 17th, 1967. "Dear Barbara Sue, Lord, I don't know who to worry more about these days, you in harm's way or your brother in California. The letters coming from Will are worrisome, that's for sure. I sent you clippings about the riot in Detroit this summer, remember, when the guard was called in? There were other riots, too, in Buffalo, Flint, New York City, Houston, lots of cities. Cops clobbering on us Negroes, looting. I just found out that Will was in Detroit that day, rioting. 33 black folks died. I'm afraid. Ever since your brother got back from Vietnam, he's been angry in a way that will get him killed. Those college white boys might get away with violence at their protests, but it won't fly for Will and his Black Panther friends. I know you're busy, but maybe you could call him. He might listen to his big sister. Lord knows he won't listen to his mama. Thinks I ought to be mad as a hornet. But what good will that do? Me breaking a window or marching across a bridge won't change a thing. He forgets I saw your Uncle Joey get lynched for looking wrong at a white lady. That wasn't all that long ago. Anyway, we miss you plenty back here, counting the days till you're home. Love, Mama."
"Lieutenant Johnson?"
Barb looked up. Talkback, the camp's radio operator, stood beside them. He was a skinny kid from Nebraska with apple cheeks and a swizzle stick neck.
"Lieutenants Johnson and McGrath, I have a message for you both from Lieutenant Melvin Turner."
"Who's that?" Barb asked.
"Coyote, ma'am, of the Seawolves."
"Your water ski buddy," Barb said to Frankie.
"He said to tell you there's gonna be a shit-kicking good, his words, ma'ams, bon voyage party at a club in Saigon tonight, and it sure would be sad to see the two purtiest nurses in Nam miss it. There's a C-7 at the airfield right now."
"That sounds like an order, Talkback. I usually prefer a printed party invitation," Frankie said.
"Engraved," Barb added. Talkback looked nervous. "Coyote didn't make it sound like much of a question, ma'am. I reckon he figured you'd love to get off the compound for a while. That plane won't stick around for long. It's on a supply run."
Barb folded up her letter. "Thanks, Talkback."
"I do hate being told what to do," Frankie said.
"And being taken for granted," Barb added. Then they both smiled and said, "Out of here," at the same time. The two women ran to the hooch and packed for an overnight trip. Less than 15 minutes later, packed and dressed in civilian clothes with their military script converted into Vietnamese money, Frankie and Barb boarded the fixed-wing cargo plane and sat down. At Ton Son Nhut, an MP escorted Frankie and Barb to a waiting jeep. They jumped in the back seat. Amazingly, this was Frankie's first close-up view of Saigon in daylight. The city was a chaotic mess, streets teeming with army tanks and armed military men and MPs, bicycles and pedestrians fighting to make their way around them, Whole families sat crowded on scooters that zipped in and out of traffic. They passed a skinny Vietnamese woman squatting on a corner, cutting vegetables on a wooden board. Military vehicles jockeyed for position with motorbikes and bicycles. Horns honked. Bike bells clanged. People yelled at one another. Three-wheeled vehicles threaded aggressively in and around the motorbikes, belched out great plumes of black smoke. The Saigon police, called the White Mice by Americans because of their white uniforms, managed traffic where the lights didn't work or weren't being obeyed. Barbed wire and oil drums and sandbags protected the government buildings. On one corner, there was a floral memorial for one of the Buddhist monks who'd self-immolated to protest the South Vietnamese government's treatment of them. No doubt the police would take it all away, and the flowers would appear again tomorrow. The jeep pulled up in front of the Caravelle Hotel, which dominated an entire street corner. Frankie jumped out, slung her worn, faded overnight bag over her shoulder, and thanked the driver. Barb came up beside her.
Damn, those flights make me thirsty.
Smiling, they headed for the hotel's glass double-door entrance. They spent the day in the old French Quarter of Saigon, with its gorgeous, ornate buildings and tree-lined streets. It was like seeing a beautiful corner of Paris through a dirty window. You could sense what it once had been, this city. Picture the French occupiers dining on foie gras and drinking fine wine while the Vietnamese cooks and waiters struggled to feed their families on paltry pay. At 1200 hours, they went to a small French-style bistro with white tablecloths and uniformed waiters and fresh flowers. Frankie was struck by the incongruity of this place existing in a land torn apart by war. It was as if they'd crossed some magical portal that led back in time.
Just go with it, Barb said, touching her arm. We'll be back in the shit soon enough.
Trust Barb to know exactly what Frankie was feeling. She slipped her arm through Barb's, and they followed the host to a table by a window, where they sat down and ordered lunch. Inside, the roar and clatter of the city faded, and the sweet fragrance of fish and broth replaced the outside odors of exhaust and diesel fuel. After lunch, they walked from shop to shop, buying new clothes and sneakers and candles and scented body lotion. Frankie bought a t-shirt that read, Ski Vietnam. They each ordered an ao yai to be made in soft, diaphanous silk, and Frankie bought a bolt of silver silk shantung for her mother and an ornate brass cigar cutter for her father. At 16:15 hours, they returned to their hotel and readied for the party at the club. What a treat! Hot, hot water and lots of it. Scented soaps and lotions. Frankie put on a new purple dress with a white plastic hip belt and a pair of sandals. When she looked in the mirror, she saw herself for the first time in 8 months. Eyes still a vibrant blue, pale skin freckled by the sun, lips so chapped lipstick didn't work, hair shaggy and grown out at different lengths. Her face was thin. She'd lost so much weight that her upper arms were like pencils. Barb came up beside her, put an arm around her. They stared at their reflections. Barb wore navy blue knit bell-bottom pants and a white shirt with a bold geometric silk tie around her neck. A headband accentuated how big her afro was getting.
I didn't know I'd lost so much weight, Frankie said. And why did I buy this ridiculous dress today? Did I want to be Grace Kelly at war?
It made you think of home. Cookies coming out of the oven, Dad's martini, or in your case, your mother's.
Frankie smiled. Barb was right. Frankie had bought this dress because it made her think of home, of her mother, of the life that girls like her had been taught to want in the 1950s, when conformity was all important. No more. Frankie might be a virgin, but she didn't want to be a good girl anymore. Life was too short to miss out on anything because of an older generation's rules. She changed into the new blue and white gingham pants she'd bought and a white fitted tunic top with bell sleeves. At the last minute, she added the white plastic hip belt. Come on, let's go. They went up to the rooftop bar and ate a delicious dinner overlooking the chaos of the city below. At 20:15 hours, they left the hotel and found an MP waiting for them. They drove through the hectic, busy streets and pulled up in front of a seedy-looking club where a sign tacked up over the door read, "Bon voyage, Hawk," in bold black script. Inside the murky interior, a bar ran from end to end. In front of it, officers in fatigues and khakis and t-shirts and jeans stood shoulder to shoulder, clapping each other in challenges and congratulations, drinking cocktails that contained actual ice cubes. Vietnamese waitresses moved through the crowd, serving drinks and food. Others cleared the tables. A dance floor had been created by pushing tables to the walls. Several couples danced in the middle of the room. A three-piece band played unrecognizable music. Two ceiling fans whopped quietly overhead, pushing the hot air around rather than cooling it. At the bar, Coyote saw Frankie and waved. He approached Frankie with an endearing hesitation that reminded her of life back in the world, of first dates and school dances. Not the usual pilot swagger at all.
"You look beautiful, Frankie. May I have this dance?"
"You may," she said. It felt so ridiculously old-fashioned and otherworldly that she had to laugh. He pulled her into his arms and onto the dance floor. She felt his hand settle on her hip. She moved his hand back up to her waist. Apparently, there was more good girl left in her than she'd thought.
"I think you've confused me with a different kind of girl."
"No way, Frankie. You're the kind of girl a guy brings home to his ma. I knew that the minute I met you at the beach party."
"I sure used to be," she said. "Thanks for the invitation tonight, by the way."
"I've been thinking about you since we met,"
Coyote said. The next song sped up in tempo, and he twirled her around until she was out of breath and dizzy. For a beautiful moment, she was just a girl in the arms of a boy who thought she was special. She was well past the glowing stage her mother had often warned her about. In this heat, she was sweating, and she loved it.
"Frankie, there's Riot. I want you to meet my new CEO,"
Coyote said, taking her by the hand. Frankie stumbled along, laughing at his quick change. One minute he was trying to touch her ass, and the next he was dragging her off the dance floor. He stopped so abruptly she bumped into him. Coyote's hand slid down her bare arm. His fingers took hold of hers.
"Riot,"
Coyote said.
"I'd like you to meet my girl."
"Your girl? I'm hardly..." Frankie laughed and looked up at Coyote's commanding officer, who was dressed in fatigues and wearing aviator sunglasses. He looked like a CIA agent, or a rock star. His stance and demeanor screamed regulation.
"Well, well," he said,
and slowly lowered the sunglasses.
"Frankie McGrath."
Rye Walsh. Frankie was momentarily plunged back in time to the 4th of July party when Finley had brought home his new best friend.
"Rye like the whiskey," she said, feeling a tightness in her throat.
He made her think of Finley, of home, of innocent schoolgirl crushes. He pulled her into his arms, gave her a hug so fierce she was lifted off her feet.
"Wait, you two know each other?"
Coyote said, frowning, looking from one to the other.
"He went to the Naval Academy with my big brother," Frankie said, stepping back. "He was the one who told me that women could be heroes."
Coyote put his arm around Frankie, pulled her close. She pulled free. Rye put his sunglasses back on.
"Well, I don't want to intrude on your fun, kids. Carry on. Nice to see you again, Frankie."
He turned on one heel, a parade smooth gesture, and walked back to the bar. 13.
"What do you know about your CO?" Frankie asked.
"He's tough as nails. Doesn't talk much about himself. I hear he's engaged to some admiral's daughter. You probably know him better than we do."
"No," Frankie said. "I didn't really know him well.
An admiral's daughter, huh? Engaged. It's hardly surprising.
Why?
Frankie almost said, look at him, but held her tongue. Even with Coyote's arms around her, slow dancing, Frankie found her gaze drawn again and again to Rye. She watched the way he laughed with his men, the way he stood apart from them sometimes. She could tell how much they respected him. Every glance took her back to Finley's going away party, when she hadn't been able to look away either, and their moment in her father's office. Women can be heroes. Those words, his words, to an impressionable 20-year-old had led her inevitably to this room, this war. It felt like fate, them meeting here.
I have my own room, Frankie,
Coyote said, nuzzling her neck as they danced.
We could be alone.
Coyote, she said quietly. He drew back, looked at her.
You're right. I should ask you out for a real date. I want to do this right with you, Frankie.
The music changed. There was a crash of furniture and a rise of laughter. At the edge of the dance floor, Barb had missed the chair and fallen to the floor. Frankie pulled out of Coyote's arms and went to her friend. Rye was there first, helping Barb to her feet. Barb threw her arms around Rye's neck and hung on.
My bones melted,
she said. Her head lolled back, and she grinned drunkenly at Frankie.
Look at this one, Frankie.
Frankie turned to Rye. The way he looked at her was unnerving, too intense. It made her feel strange, fluttery. I should get her back to the caravel.
I'll get an MP to drive you.
Rye helped maneuver Barb out of the O Club and to an MP Jeep. Frankie climbed in beside her. Coyote came out of the O Club.
Frankie, I'll come to see.
Bye, Coyote, Frankie said, waving as the Jeep took off. Back at the hotel, she helped Barb up the stairs and into their room. While Barb was peeing, she looked up, bleary-eyed, and said,
Don't let me fall off the toilet. My balance is for shit.
Whiskey, Frankie said, and they both laughed. Frankie helped Barb out of her clothes and into bed.
Do you see the cat in the sunglasses?
Barb said, flopping back onto the clean white sheets.
Good-looking man.
I saw him, Frankie said, pulling the covers up to Barb's chin. With the lights out and to the sound of Barb snoring, Frankie tried to sleep. It should have been easy. She had drunk plenty tonight, and there was no fear of a mortar attack or a mask owl to waken her in the middle of the night. She was on clean, fresh sheets. Still, sleep eluded her. She felt restless, anxious. The phone rang. She answered before it wakened Barb. Hello?
Miss McGrath,
said a Vietnamese man in French-accented English.
There's a young man here to see you. He asks that you meet him at the top floor bar.
Coyote. Frankie didn't want to see him now, but she owed him the truth. He wasn't the man for her. And she couldn't sleep anyway. She threw back the covers and dressed in jeans and a t-shirt and went to the elevator, which was out of order. Sighing, she walked up four flights of stairs and emerged onto the hotel's dimly lit rooftop bar. A three-piece band sent music out across an empty dance floor. She could see a small group of men and women huddled in one corner, all of them smoking and talking loudly, arguing. She could hear typewriters clacking. Journalists. She'd heard that this bar was one of their hangouts, along with the bar at the Rex Hotel. She wondered what they were arguing about, if their perspectives on the war were as at odds as her own, if they were as divided as America seemed to be. Frankie walked over to a quiet table by a window and sat down. In the moonlight, the Continental Hotel across the street was dark, except for a few illuminated rooms. She couldn't help thinking of Jamie, who long ago had told her about this romantic rooftop bar. Sadness tainted the memory, left a sharp little bite, and then softened into regret. She tried instead to imagine him at home with his family, but couldn't quite manage that kind of optimism. A slim Vietnamese woman appeared quietly to take Frankie's drink order. Moments later, she returned with a glass of Sancerre. Frankie took a sip of the wine as she stared out at the night lights of Saigon. Even with music playing, the noise of the war was ever present. the whir of a helicopter flying over the city, the pop of gunfire. Here and there, streaks of red arced through the night sky like fireworks. Orange fires blossomed. From here, the war was almost beautiful. Maybe that was a fundamental truth. War looked one way for those who saw it from a safe distance. Close up, the view was different.
Frankie.
Rye. She looked up in surprise. The Vietnamese waitress glided effortlessly into place beside Rye.
Scotch, neat, Rye said.
When the waitress left, Rye sat down opposite Frankie, saying nothing until he had his drink in front of him and the waitress had gone.
Seeing you was like going back in time.
Yeah.
Finley was the best friend I ever had.
Me too.
He sat back, studied her.
So, a combat nurse. I would have thought you'd be married to a millionaire's son by now.
Some guy I met at a party told me that women could be heroes. No one had ever said anything like that to me before.
I don't think you needed to hear it from me,
he said, his gaze steady on hers. She couldn't help wondering what he saw when he looked at her. Finley's kid sister? Or did he see who she'd become?
I did need to hear it, she said quietly.
The music changed to something unrecognizable. He said,
dance with me.
As a girl, she'd dreamed about this moment with him. As a woman, she knew how fragile dreams were, and this war had taught her to dance while she could. She got to her feet. He took her hand in his and led her to the dance floor. She fit up against him, felt his arms encircle her. They moved in time to the music, but they weren't really dancing. She would have sworn she could feel his heart beating against hers. He looked down, and she saw desire in his eyes. No man had ever looked at her like this, as if he wanted to devour her, bones and all. When the song ended, she pulled free.
We probably shouldn't dance, she said, feeling shaky. You're engaged, from what I hear.
She's a long way away.
Frankie managed a smile, but only barely. They were not the words she wanted to hear from him.
I've already had my heart broken over here, she said quietly, taking another step back. And I expect an officer to be a gentleman, Rye.
He locked his hands behind his back. Soldier's stance, a respectful distance.
Forgive me for coming here tonight.
His voice had a rough edge to it.
It wasn't my place.
She nodded, tried again to smile.
Stay alive, Rye. I'm seeing too many bird pilots in my OR.
Goodbye, Frankie.
Goodbye.
Frankie tossed and turned all night, her sleep plagued by sharp, unfamiliar longings. When she woke, it was late morning, and sunlight streamed through the clean glass windows. Her first thought was of Rye. That dance, and the way he'd looked at her. She got out of bed, saw that Barb had left her a meet-you-at-breakfast note. Downstairs, she found Barb already seated at the hotel restaurant, drinking a Bloody Mary.
Hair of the dog, she said.
What happened last night? How did I get back to the hotel? I used my superhuman strength and carried you.
Ugh, that's good for the reputation.
You were dressed the whole time, if that helps. And there was no public vomiting. You may or may not have used the men's bathroom.
The waitress returned with a second Bloody Mary, which she handed to Frankie.
I know I was drunk as shit last night, but you were acting weird, Barb said.
Was I?
Something about the casual response put Barb on alert.
So now I know there's a story. Spill the beans, girl.
Frankie sighed. Finn used to bring his Naval Academy friends home in the summer. They seemed like gods to me. She smiled, a little one, and thought maybe it was too sad to be real. Rye Walsh was his best friend. The CO in the sunglasses last night, I had a huge crush on him.
The guy who looks like Paul Newman?
Wow.
So grab his hand and show him
he's engaged.
Shit. Not again.
Barb took a drink.
And you're a damn good girl.
When I danced with Jamie, I felt safe. Loved, I guess. It was like being home. But with Rye, when I was in his arms, I felt... I mean, the way he looked at me was... hungry. Almost scary.
It's called lust, Frankie. And it can rock your good girl world.
Back at the 71st, the only thing that ever changed was the weather. By December, the days were uniformly hot and dry. Now, with the temperature rising to 110 degrees in the OR, Frankie was hot and headachy. She hadn't slept well since Saigon. The OR doors opened, and a pair of medics rolled a soldier in from pre-op. He was face down on the gurney, his naked, bloody butt stuck up in the air. One of the medics was laughing at something. A good sign.
Butt shot,
he yelled to Frankie, who showed the medics to an empty table and snapped on a new set of gloves. The kid on the stretcher craned his neck around to look at Frankie.
I got me a fine black ass, don't I?
He said, with a glassy-eyed smile that revealed he'd been given some morphine for the pain. He was barely over 18, Frankie would guess.
I'm Albert Brown, private first class.
Hey, Private Brown. Yes, you do have one fine ass, I'd say. Too bad I'm going to have to pick shrapnel out of it.
She waved over the male nurse anesthetist, nicknamed Gas Man, who injected a local anesthetic. When the patient's buttocks were numb, Frankie bent over his backside and went to work, tweezing out jagged bits of shrapnel. It would hurt like hell if he could feel it, and he would when the drugs wore off.
Where are you from, Albert?
Kentucky, ma'am. Land of bourbon and good-looking men.
With fine asses, Frankie said. He laughed.
I'm glad to represent, ma'am.
When she had finished, cleaned him up, and bandaged his backside, she called for a medic to take him to post-op.
Wait, ma'am, he said. Can you take a picture with me for my mama, Shirley? She'd love that.
Frankie smiled tiredly. It was a common request.
Sure, Albert. But your ass looks like it's been chewed by wolves, and so does my hair.
Albert grinned.
No way, ma'am. You're the prettiest girl who has ever touched my butt.
Frankie couldn't help but laugh. She leaned down and let the kid's friend snap a Polaroid picture of them. With a wave, she sent him off to recovery and peeled off her gloves, tossing them away and reaching for a new pair. She was thinking about going for a soda when she heard choppers. Several of them. She glanced across the OR, made eye contact with Barb, who looked as exhausted as Frankie felt. The two nurses ran for the helipad, their feet lost in a cloud of red dirt. They helped offload the wounded and guided them back to triage. There, they moved through the wounded fast, barking out orders, prioritizing treatment. They were almost done when Frankie heard, "Where do you want him, ma'am?" Two medics appeared, with a wounded man on a litter between them. She took one look at this casualty's wound and said, "OR stat," and ran along beside the medics. In the OR, she pointed to an empty table and called for Charlene, the newest nurse at the 71st. The poor thing was fresh off the plane from Kansas. This would be her first shift. "Charlene," Frankie said, thrusting a pair of scissors at her. "Cut off his clothes." The young blonde woman stared down at the blood falling from the soldier's chest and onto her shiny black combat boots. Frankie saw the woman's fear and thought, "Take a breath, Frankie." She forced her voice to soften as she said,
"Look at me. Charlene."
Charlene's eyes were full of tears.
"Yes, ma'am."
"It's scary, I know, but you can cut his clothes away and take off his boot. You're a registered nurse." Charlene took the scissors in shaking hands and went to the end of the table. Staring down at what was left of the soldier's left leg, she began to cut away the blood and mud-soaked pants leg. The patient sat up suddenly, saw his mangled leg.
"Where's my foot? Where's my foot?
Doc, over here!"
Frankie reached for a shot of morphine and administered it.
"This will help. You'll be okay, Corporal."
"I'm a bulldogger, ma'am,"
he said, starting to slur his words as the morphine took effect.
"In Oklahoma. You smell mighty fine, ma'am, like my girl back home."
"It's Jean Nate perfume.
What's a bulldogger, Marine? Frankie said, looking for a surgeon.
Rodeo, ma'am. I surely need that foot.
Frankie yelled, Is there a damn doc here, or am I going to do this kid's surgery myself? On her birthday, after a long shift in the OR, Frankie headed to the park, where a party was in full swing. Barb and Slim were standing by the dirty, leaf-infested pool. A banner had been strung between two dying banana trees, Happy Birthday, Frankie. A small, tired-looking group of nurses and doctors whooped and clapped at her arrival. Coyote saw Frankie. He leaned over the tiki bar, poured a drink, and brought it to her. In the days since she'd seen him at the O Club in Saigon, he'd shaved his mustache. He looked younger.
Happy birthday, Frankie. I'm glad I could be here. Dance with me?
She started to say no, but when she looked in his eyes and saw how hard he was working to smile, she realized that they were alike, just trying to conceal the pain of every day here, tired of being alone.
Give me a chance, Frankie. I'm a good man.
He sounded so earnest, and she knew he meant it, knew that it made sense to do as he asked. So she let herself be pulled forward. She wouldn't sleep with him, wouldn't even let him kiss her. That would be wrong, to lead him on that way. But just now, she was lonely and tired. It was the wrong song and the wrong man and the wrong hand in hers, but honestly, it felt good not to be alone. And it was just a dance, after all.
Say you'll be my girl.
I'm sorry, Coyote, she said softly. For a moment, she almost hoped he hadn't heard her.
Yeah,
he whispered back, his breath hot against her ear.
I know. You're out of my league, Frankie McGrath.
She tightened her hold on him. No, Coyote, you're everything a girl could want. He drew back.
Just not you.
God, she hated this. Just not me. He pulled her close again, resumed their dance.
I love a challenge, Frankie. You should know that about me. But I'm going home soon. Short timer. So don't lose your chance.
He threw his head back and howled. But for the first time, Frankie heard the loneliness in the sound, the sorrow and the heartbreak. She wondered if it had been there all along.